Instructional Designers in Offices Drinking Coffee is brought to you by Domino, makers of Domino One, the all-in-one cloud-based e-learning authoring tool for teams. You can learn more at domino.com. That's DOMINKNOW.com. Now, here's this week's episode.
It's a Wednesday, and you know what that means? Time to be idiotic. Thanks to everybody in the chat who's joining us this week for being idiotic with us here. We're glad to have you. Sounds like the weather's pretty good in everybody's zone. Well, there's a couple of folks, I think, posting some gloomier zones, but sounds like the weather's doing a pretty good thing for everybody today, so that's nice. A good way to meet the middle of the week anyway.
Brent,
yes. Something's different. Something's different, Brent.
What?
Where the heck are you?
Oh, yes. Well, you had me worried there for a minute. Something was actually going wrong, but no, I'm actually in Nebraska today, working from my daughter's, office desk, as I had to return her to law school. And so she's enjoying some time moving apartments. And so I'm here to help. So I decided, you know what? We'll make the long 20-hour drive over the weekend. I'll just work from your place all week, and then I'll drive home the next weekend. That's a good plan.
Sounds like fun.
It's dad work.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. You know, awesome. So tons of fun. So yeah, so if things are a little bit off, if my audio is a little low for you folks in the chat, let me know. I'm kind of adjusting things as I go, but you know, just let me know and we'll go from there. But Chris, we've got a fantastic guest today. That's way more important than me.
I just thought it was important to let folks know why your background was different, because you know, our folks are pretty smart. They'll make an observation, they'll wonder. So let's get it out there on the table first of all. Yeah, yeah. Folks, we have Andrew Berry joining us here today. Andrew, it's your first time with us, so introduce yourself to our lovely collection of guests here today. Tell us a bit about yourself.
Yeah, Chris, Brent, thank you both so much for having me here and for everyone who's joined us as well. I am super pumped to have this, and that is the best intro to a live podcast recording I've ever heard. That was a lot of fun. I need to start every day like that. So my name is Andrew Berry. I'm the CEO and founder of Curious Line. So we're a learning culture advisory firm. A lot of you listening will probably pick up an accent. The assumption is that we're based in somewhere outside of the States. I'm from South Africa originally. I picked some of my team are actually in the chat here. So we're representing South Africa nicely there. But yeah, we're based in the northeast of the US, out of New Jersey now. I am absolutely passionate about this topic and I can't wait to dive in.
Very cool. Very cool. Let's start, I guess, maybe with a basic. I mean, what is a learning culture? It's kind of we hear the phrase a fair bit in our space, but, what is a learning culture? And I got to admit, part of me wants to make a joke about Petri dishes and things like that.
Making bread during COVID. Yeah. So it's a great question, and there's no single answer to that. The way I like to answer this is that every company has a learning culture, whether you like it or not, right? Mm-hmm. And the job that we help companies with is understanding what that culture is, sort of diagnosing it, and then cultivating it or shaping it in the direction that you want. So learning culture is obviously a subset of culture. We can get into that, but I think that's that's kind of a broad topic. And for those who are really interested, there's a guy called Edgar Schein that I would highly recommend. I'm going to put his name in the chat here. Go check out what he talks about for culture, because it sets the tone for understanding everything else about learning culture. So for me and for our team, learning culture is about the sort of willingness and autonomy of everyone in the company to want to seek out learning, to see that working and learning are the same things, and that by taking action, by reflecting on it, by sharing their observations with others, and by eventually teaching others what they know, that creates a culture of learning together.
Very cool. Yeah, and that was a thought that I had was, I mean, learning culture, every organization has some measure of something that might be called a learning culture. It just might not be a good one yet.
Yeah.
It might not be the most effective an approach. So it's kind of a spectrum of something as opposed to a specific, bullseye target, I would say.
Yeah. That's exactly right. And it's constantly moving. It's constantly changing. And every company's one is different, right? So that, I think that's the cool part about it. Like we have a framework and ideas for kind of how to reverse engineer it and then how to get it in place. But I think the thing I keep telling to my team is we're interested in the category of learning culture and what continuous learning looks like at companies. We're not trying to say ours is the only way to do it. So I love learning from others, companies, and I have a podcast on it as well. And, so we're constantly trying to expand the understanding of it across the industry.
Very cool. So if you were coming into an organization, I mean, are there some, questions you ask at least to begin to start like measuring the pulse of trying to figure out where they are on the spectrum of a learning culture kind of progressiveness?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sorry, you cut off for a second. I missed the first part of the question.
Yeah, no, if you were starting to engage with an organization, and I'm thinking of this just for, our own audience looking at their own organization, are there some, initial questions that you ask to sort of get started measuring where folks are at?
Yeah, definitely. So it all starts with, we have this framework called the VACE framework. And I actually didn't have that one pulled up. I might be able to get I can actually do that. Do you mind? Should I share my screen? I can kind of answer that question a bit
better. Yeah.
Awesome. So let me just do
visuals
that
are quickly. Always good, but not necessary.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Exactly. So I think it all started with this sort of fundamental understanding that, the typical way training is conceptualized and delivered at companies is, management comes and says, we need a training, and then a bunch of learning modules are created and they drop down on people. And I know you guys don't think like that either, that the real way people learn is through a learning culture, right? We learn from our peers. We learn from experts, both inside and outside the company. We learn from facilitators who can guide conversation to help us learn from each other. So it's kind of with that in mind, we have, to answer your question, we have four ways that we help companies four elements of a learning culture. And the first two are to answer your question. So one part of it is, and the questions related to this are, what does great look like? We typically say pick a role. So it can be like a vertical role, like sales or product. It could be a horizontal, like a certain level of manager or the entire company. And sort of describe like in the mindsets, behaviors, not knowledge, skills, like what does that look, what does an ideal performer in that role look like? Also recognizing there's no such thing as an ideal performer, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone's going to excel in certain areas and that, and it's the collective really that you're aiming for. Yeah. And so we can go into more detail on the exact types of questions there, but the other component of this is the shared assumptions. And that is saying, so that's where we headed. Shared assumptions are where are we now? What are people, this is looking at what is the difference between what people say they do and what they actually do. Right, because what they actually do, and specifically around problem solving, how they solve problems, is really what the culture of that company is. And so that's a whole bunch of diagnostics. Like, we will do whatever it takes to please a customer, no matter the short-term cost. Right, that may or may not be true at some companies. So it's really kind of trying to evaluate statements like that and say, that's what's happening right now. And then the shared vision is where you're headed. And I think the next slide. No, that doesn't get into that, but. I'm gonna stop that now. But that's sort of those two, picture that as like your learning journey, right? From the current state to the future state.
Right. And that's not unlike then, I guess, where we would start if we were trying to focus in on, say, improving performance in a specific role. You know, what happens now, and, yeah. and what would a better result look like? What would a better, yeah. you know, performance, you know, look like, and how are we going to measure that and think about that? So that's very exactly. cool.
Yeah. It's a little bit squishy though, right? It's like, it's very much like, it's like doing soft skills training a little bit in that every company has some sort of culture already, and it's figuring out, okay, how do we figure out what, when you say the current state and the future state, it's almost like, what's our current culture? What does it feel like? Is it toxic a little bit? Is it, you know, and do we need to kind of fix that? Kind of the whys, what, you know, why are we the way we are today? And then kind of reverse engineer the way we want it to be in the future, and trying to figure that stuff out. And I think that's the part that everybody struggles with, or at least is my assumption from all the things that I read when people talk about it and when they're trying to deal with it. And, you know, figuring out, okay, now how do we get there? Because that's a big ask, right? I mean, it's a pretty daunting task to say, we're going to change an entire culture. It's,
yeah. So, And so Sarah has a great question in the chat, which I think kind of builds on what you were just saying, right? Which is, and we can, let's go there potentially, because I think this is the interesting thing. So one caveat to all of this is that it's, to your point, it's really hard to change a culture that has been allowed time to, you know, mature and solidify, right? So, and just recognizing that even little, like just any behavior. So if you bring on in an early stage in a company, that's why I can't stand it when startups are just hiring like crazy and they don't take time to assimilate people, right? Because you bring someone else on, this is like one example, and say like you bring on a new COO, you get them from outside, hotshot, you know, killer at their profession. But they are the type of person that constantly, like, you know, sends out an email and expects a reply right away, or is calling you at 8 o'clock at night or whatever, because that's just how they've operated and that's how they've been successful. That's fine for them, but that's also going to start to permeate down into the culture of that company, right? And so you have to take time to understand those behaviors, what's actually happening on the ground. And then to your point, Brent, and I think where Sarah's headed with the question, how do you step in and sort of, what do you do once you realize that that's in place? So recognize that it takes time. And then I think the thing that we see, and if, from that diagram that I shared, the next step was shared stories, right? So what are the stories of what good looks like? Like, you know, what do we want as a collective, this company to look like from a behavioral standpoint? And it's not set from the top. Let me just qualify that. It's set from the top in terms of if those behaviors are demonstrated, but it's not decreed from above. It's not like, this is how we shall be, right? It is demonstrated. And the more people are in the company demonstrating that behavior, the more it becomes the shared story, right? And then therefore part of the shared vision. So that's super key. And so just being very conscious of those. One practical thing for people out there, with clients, we will reach out to the employee population that are going to go through the programs, and we'll look for specific examples of specific types of behavior you want to see. Where have you gone out of your way to help a customer in need? You know, that type of thing. And we will record the stories and turn that into a podcast. And that has incredible benefit, an internal private podcast feed, right, for that company to just hear what your colleagues are doing and seeing how it's impacting customers or the community or other employees. It's hugely powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's that sharing. Oh, go ahead, Chris.
I was just going to say, Freya threw in the chat lived values instead of professed values, which is a really cool way to phrase it. Yeah.
Spot on. Yeah.
Yeah. Like walk the walk, don't just talk the talk sort of thing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And no, it doesn't happen overnight. Like you have to be patient with this and just keep at it. And that's why we see it. Yeah, I talk about lifelong learning all the time. And I know you guys are advocates of this as well. It's not, you're never done, right? You're always learning. Another thing that's a healthy learning culture is where people see mistakes and failures as learning opportunities, right? So it's not like you don't want that culture where someone's like afraid to try something new, right? Because you're just never gonna get new ideas coming out of there. So, you know, we help build those sort of infrastructure or systems for that to happen within them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How much of this culture have you seen maybe can't be changed? Like, are there any cultural things that you see happening? And then you just have to tell executives or whoever's running the company, no matter the department, no matter how big it is, that, it, you know what, this, you've either got an extremely uphill climb or you kind of need to swap out people or, you know, if you wanted to change. I mean, have you ever had to have those types of difficult conversations?
Yeah, it's such a good question. I don't think I could pinpoint a single behavior because it sort of depends on the individual. But I think that's the key, is that it depends on the individual. So where things cannot change, and you've sort of alluded to it in your question, is that the person at the top refuses for whatever reason to demonstrate that that the other behavior, right, the opposite of what they're doing. And it's often for something like it's a pet peeve of theirs, right? And so they see like this is something that has to happen, or it's an anxiety or fear that they're avoiding through some kind of behavior. They don't, they're not self-aware enough to recognize that. And then it permeates through the whole company. So you alluded to this earlier, like it's a softer type skill.
To me,
there's a lot of debate out there, right? Like what is a better name? Is it power skills, that kind of stuff? To me, an interesting thing to throw into that mix is tacit knowledge. So it's like the how that things get done. That type of stuff you cannot put in a playbook. You can't, you know, put in an e-learning and expect people to know. Like that's, and we should talk about this as well. Like I think where authoring tools like Domino like come in, because I think they play a key role in this. But the tacit knowledge comes from people talking and people and talking about and sharing their experiences of how they did something or how they approached something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sarah threw into the chat a description here. You know, what does that conversation sound like when in that existing bad culture, the leadership asks you as the training department to, quote, fix morale, end quote, with a single event, for example, a 3-day seminar. I had that asked of me in a previous company and I was just gobsmacked at the ask. And Adam replies, Sarah, leadership thinks of culture problems as a blemish that the L&D dermatologists can just burn off with learning. So
that's so descriptive. I love that.
Yeah.
That's a great metaphor, yeah.
Yeah. I love that, Sarah, and I totally agree with you. I am gobsmacked by that as well. So I always say training as an event is dead. Learning as a process is what the future is, right? And so think of it as like, I mean, in that specific example, you have to go back to leadership and say, look, a 3-day seminar is never going to fix anything, you know? Like Edgar Schein talks about this as well. Like you can create these like amazing offsites, right? And a lot of companies are doing that now, as you know, to combat being remote or to complement it. And you know, so you send people to a bunch of to a great offsite, and they climb trees and they row, you know, canoes, and like that's not learning, right? Like you coerced that. Like that's not actually learning. People haven't taken that out of their own volition and. So it's a little artificial. And so that's why I kind of come back to the fact that this is something that takes time. It's an ongoing process. And it comes down, I always try and bring it back to basics. Like we learn best from, and we can talk about the circle of learning, because this is, I think, key. Do you want to, I can maybe bring that up now if you guys.
While you're doing that, I'll share one, a personal experience. Prior to this career, I was in a different career and just, you know, relatively new in an organization, et cetera. And the organization paid basically, you know, a company of 60, 80 people in that frame and put most of us offsite for a day with a team building facilitator. And, you know, we did all the exercises and activities and all those sorts of things. And, you know, part of that included reflection, you know, about what might be better, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And I said, as everyone was filtering out at the end of the day, I took a moment because the whole process, you know, had my fascination brain going, oh, this is really fascinating how this is all working. And I said to the facilitator, I said, you know, in that reflection exercise, the only thing I could think of that could be better was one specific person. And I didn't name the person. I just said one specific person.
I wonder who.
And the facilitator looked at me and said, a lot of people have said that about a specific person. And a couple of years later, finally, change actually happened. That seemed to be the thing that it was, you know, that was the keystone, I think, that needed to be shifted, obviously.
Yeah. Anyway. And it's so fundamental, right? It's like just that, like changing that way of looking at it, you probably unlock that for others as well through that realization. And so, like, I mean, to me, this comes back to a lot of this conversation. I think this is always a helpful grounding. I shared this on LinkedIn last week, and it really resonated for people. So if you can't see that, I'm calling this the circle of learning, but this is not going to sound, let me not actually even just carry out this. The bigger the circle gets, the more learning's happening, right? And so in my observation, it starts with doing, right? So the step before this is consuming. Okay, so that, and I think that's a very important step. I'll sort of talk about where I see authoring tools like Domino can come in, is that it gives people an opportunity to create powerful asynchronous content that can introduce new mental models and frameworks for people. That's so important, right? So you need to expose people to new ways of thinking, basically, and give them a new language for looking at current problems. But then they got to do something with that, right? So they got to go take action, and that's apply it in a customer interview or a performance review or something related to your work. And if you stop there, that's how much you learn. But if you then reflect on that, so what went well, what didn't go well, what would I do differently next time? You're expanding. This is double loop learning, right? Chris Argyris, an incredible writer from the late 80s, talks about that. So double loop learning, you're now reflecting on the doing part of what you're doing. If you start sharing that with people, you start to get feedback on your ideas, right? You start to hear some of their ideas. You start to see patterns. You start to assimilate more information about that topic and experiences about that topic. So doing, reflecting, and sharing gets it even more. So to Adam's point, the tacit knowledge is where that a lot of people are sharing. They're sharing their tacit knowledge. And then I think for me, the thing that really brings this together is when you have to teach it to someone else. And the best examples of this I've seen in companies is when someone who's just learned the thing or is just one or two steps ahead of someone else has to teach it to someone, you know, who's less experienced, because both of them are learning, right? Because first of all, that person knows exactly what it was like to be in the shoes of the person who's less experienced. So they have a better way of explaining to them. And secondly, because you are forced to explain something to someone, like try and explain to a five-year-old, right? Like it's that whole Feynman technique thing. Like you will very quickly realize where you don't understand something and you need to go back to the drawing board to understand it, right? So you accelerate your own learning. And that is the virtuous cycle that we try and create at companies, right? Through these systems of learning where people are doing, reflecting, sharing, and teaching constantly.
Yeah. And the description you just had of someone who's a little bit ahead of someone teaching someone as opposed to that reflects, you know, some things that we already know too, that, you know, people who are high performance or who are highly expert, have high expertise in an area, often forget what it's like to, you know, not know something, right? You know, they have so much built in assumptions in floating them through everything, you know, that it's hard for them to realize that, I need to put this in a different way so that that someone who isn't where I'm at can actually connect with the information, et cetera, which is often a challenge that we have in our space, you know, working with SMEs who want to give everything, you know, as part of a program.
That's such a great point. For anybody who works with SMEs that have that, go look up the earned dogmatism effect. It was a study in out of Loyola. I forget when it was, but the earned dogmatism effect is exactly what you're saying. And it just really explains, like, oh, that's why the SME just can't explain this thing properly or thinks everything is important. And I have to include it all, you know, that all of those kind of problems that all comes from the earned dogmatism effect.
That's a great phrase. Yeah. I've never heard a label attached to that. Yeah, we all deal with it and we all talk about it all the time.
Totally.
We see people complaining about it on LinkedIn and on social media and whatnot, but that's a great phrase. I'm going to look that up later and check that out. And James got it. That's a good example in there. Who wants to read that?
Oh, go ahead.
I planned and delivered a learning symposium at my company this year. And as one of the planners, I knew that creating a circumstance over 2 days that engaged participants in real time, but also had built-in follow-up check-ins set throughout the rest of the year, built-in was crucial. Learners need to know that culture building was going to continue to be supported, that their ideas would be taken into account, and that next year it wasn't going to be dropped in favor of some other program. If not, they won't invest, in my opinion. And this is this is true to your point about it being, training as an event, but learning as a process and a long-term process at that, right? And, and technology supports both, right? We use technology for training events, and we use technology to support the long-term learning process. And by building and designing different, different types of content and interventions, which is where I think we can best, as instructional designers, start to play a nice role in this changing of the culture. I think this is the question that I think that comes my way quite a bit, because we see this changing the culture as this massive thing, and people get a little freaked out. And I think understanding realistically where your skills, if you're on the L&D team, you know, what particular level you're at, or if you're an instructional designer, if you're e-learning developer, if you're LMS administrator, if you're the training manager, or if you're the L&D executive or your CLO, you know, all these different elements of those roles, how do they play in driving this culture? Because it is a little bit overwhelming, right?
Yeah, 100%. 100%. And I think so there's something I can offer for folks out there. And I think this is what James is describing. It sounds like, so we call this a cohort learning experience. It sounds like that's similar to this learning symposium idea, with the crucial part at the end there, the follow-up check-ins throughout the rest of the year. And so if you go back to that VACE framework, so there was the V and the A. So, you know, where you headed, where you are. The S is those shared stories of what does good look like, to get people committed to the process, to get them to see, like, you know, where we headed, and sort of spread the I want to say, like, passion for learning, right? Because, like, once you see what can be possible, you want to go and learn how to do that, right? And so that's sort of the benefit of that. The E is the most important part. And that's, I think, what James has done a great job of describing. And so that's experiences, or shared experiences. And like I said, we call them cohort learning experiences. And so what I always, we do this for every single client, and you can do this in your company. So there are three components to a cohort learning experience that you can start right now, and you can start this process. And it's like a flywheel, right? Go back to, like, Jim Collins, Good to Great, flywheel effects. That you do one of these, it's going to take some time to get people excited. And maybe you have some follow-up questions on that kind of stuff afterwards. But more you do it, the more it starts to take root. And those three things are asynchronous content. So that's where a tool like Domino would come in really, really handy, right? To curate and create content that can introduce new models, new ways of thinking. Then there's practice and reflection. So what I'll be very specific here. We get people to consume some content, then reflect on what it means to them. So say it's like sales training, and it's specific to negotiating a contract with a client. So think of a client that you're currently negotiating. How can you try this new model for negotiation? And so basically what people end up doing is they write, like, their own scenario or case study, right? Which is so much better than us trying to come up with a scenario that meets everyone's needs and standards, right? And like, no one can do it as well as the people that are actually in that role. So now everyone's done that, or at least most people, right? Those that are motivated. And the more you do this, the more are motivated. So then people come with these scenarios and case studies to so that's practice and reflection. I'll come back to practice as well. The third piece is the live session. And that's where all the magic happens. This can be remote. It could be in person. Hybrid works really well as well. And the goal of this is you get a really good facilitator who knows the business. And so we train the trainers, you know, with our clients to get them to be able to facilitate these. And they just need to ask good questions and get people talking about those scenarios. Now they've got a common language or a new model of thinking, thanks to the asynchronous content they've gone through. They've got their specific scenario that they've already thought about. And now they can start helping each other. Right? And most of those scenarios are challenges that someone's like a roadblock, right, that someone has. And so this is when I say we integrate working and learning, because at the end of that 60 or 90 minute session, like, these people have answers to those things. You know, they go off and take an action. They go and have that meeting with that client and try that new, you know, approach. And that's the action part, right? And so then just repeat that cycle, you know, and now pick a new topic and introduce them to some new way of thinking about it, get them to reflect on it, get them to talk about it with each other, and then get them to take action. And just repeat that over and over again. And I promise you, we've seen so much success at companies who adopt this.
Man, that, that's it, it's I don't know why I keep going to the negative part of culture, but you know, just thinking through all of these different things, you mentioned sales, and I, the first thing that comes to my mind is just remembering and recognizing, having worked with some sales teams in the past, you know, you've always got a few people, those high, there's always super high performers that are just selling like crazy, but they're a bit toxic and they don't want to play. They just want to sell. And executives really like that. So I think sales departments are unique in this, you know, world of driving the business culture. And so my question, I guess, would be, have you discovered, you know, in your work, is there a particular department or area that is easier to start changing an internal culture versus others? Like, is manufacturing, you know, one particular way? Is, you know, operations another way? Again, sales, working with the executive team, you know, any, you know, planning and logistics, like, is there a place where you typically like to start first, or?
So it's a funny, it's a really good question. And funny enough, sales is actually often where we do start. I think that might have to do more to do with the fact that they have the budget to spend on something like this, right? So I think that plays into this a little bit. I definitely would say where we've seen the most success is with people that are in delivery executive or account executive roles. So there's like a client service element, and then manager training. So, I mean, our typical like approach, entry point, I guess, into clients is through sales. And then often, because a consistency is so important across the customer lifecycle, they'll introduce us to the AE team. And then eventually with success there, we'll do manager training. But I do think, like, I think it gets better the more you go through that level. So the manager training is, we've had PagerDuty is one of my favorite examples. It's been our longest client. We've been doing this with them for 3 years. And in fact, we piloted the whole idea of CLX, the cohort learning experience, with them. And there's some, so Felicia Jones is their head of people development. She is phenomenal. People should check her out on LinkedIn. And she's a really forward thinker. She saw the potential of this and we put it in place there. It's because I think because it's that tacit knowledge, right? Managing people is not something you can read a textbook about, right? You can't. You can get good ideas and insights in that, but like until you're putting it into practice and experience learning from others, you don't take it to that next level. That's definitely, I think, where you can see if you are in a role right now and you want to put this in place, I would start right there.
Yeah, it's difficult. It's not one of the easiest things for any of us to be dealing with. It's not like you can just build a training event. It's not like you can, you know, we're so used to, I think our industry as a whole has never really thought of things like this as our job, right? Like we do instructional design stuff and it is a specific problem, is a task, or there's a specific area in the manufacturing area that's having a problem, and you decide if it's a knowledge gap or a skills gap, and then you build some training to fill that gap, you fix that problem, everybody starts doing it right, and you're good to go, right? It's very you can tell when you've been successful or not, I guess is what I'm getting to, right? Something like this, like you mentioned earlier, is a long-term process to try to know as whether or not you've been impactful or not, which is a lot of times makes it difficult for companies to invest in it. So to have that champion, like you were talking about, the company you're at, is critical for this type of success.
Yeah. It's such a good point you bring up because it's one of our challenges, right? To get into a new company because of that, right? So it's really, it's identifying that person who gets this and then enabling them to be able to do their job better.
Yeah.
But I think that's kind of one of the keys here, right? Because it does, I think any person who's responsible for enabling or people development, I think they serve that audience so much better if they themselves invest in their own training and understanding and knowledge and skills, right? And like there's such a lack of that in this industry. You know, a lot of people I see and work with that are in these roles, and I used to as well. Like like it's so ironic, right? We're all responsible for like hundreds and thousands of people development, but we don't actually take time to develop ourselves. And I think that's a really good starting point for folks as well listening, is to learn some of these skills and how to put them in place.
Mm-hmm. Something I was thinking about as you were showing the diagram, you know, the reflection aspects, et cetera, mm-hmm. of that process, is it does take a fair bit of a sense of safety in order to carry out some of those tasks, yeah. right? You've got pressure on you to improve, but you're being asked as well to pause, in a sense.
Yeah.
And it's not a skill that we really grow up, you know, being valued, you know, that reflection. It's yeah. you know, go, right? Especially in certain, yeah. you know, fields like sales, et cetera. So,
yeah.
You know, part of the learning culture must be then being able to create that sense of, and it may not be capital S safety, but creating that safeness that you can carry out these things without fear of it, you know, monkeying other stuff up, or et cetera.
Yeah. Chris, I'm so glad you brought that up, because that's really like one of the cornerstone pillars of learning culture is mm-hmm. safety or trust in that environment. Yeah. And part of the reason it's not easy for folks is that this isn't my idea. This was written by Chris Agaris. I think it's so insightful, is that anybody who's in one of these roles, right? High performers, right? Anybody who's in a management role, like, they've very rarely experienced failure, right? They were great at high school. They were great at college. They got the job they wanted. They moved up the ranks. Like, they're very unfamiliar with failure. Right. And then you realize, as you get more and more, you know, in higher up in your career, is like, you just, there's so much more complexity and so many more things that can happen that cause that failure. And so most people avoid it, deny it, you know, blame others for it. Like, there's a lot of ways to say that wasn't me. Right. So they disassociate from that failure. The really great leaders lean into that failure and embrace it. Talk about it with people, share it, you know, what they learn from it, and learn from it, right? And do something different with it. And I think that's so difficult for people. And I get it. Like, I totally get why it's difficult, because of all those, you know, we're just not used to it, right? And so I think the only way to really tackle this problem is to sort of start with the individuals, and to start at the highest part of the company, and to try. If that leader is not okay with this, is to try and socialize that behavior. And I'm saying this as out loud, and as I'm saying, I'm thinking, like, it's really hard to come in and do that and change someone who has gotten to that point in their career, right? I just think the more you can demonstrate that behavior yourself, the better. So if anybody's, you know, again, in that role now, and maybe their leaders don't demonstrate that, if you start to do that, your team will notice first, right? They will totally see it and embrace it. And I think people will then start to recognize that, and that will spread. So we've definitely seen that happen. The more people that embrace this, the more the concept, the feeling of it spreads, the more people start to do it. So that's probably the best advice, is just model that behavior yourself and hope and watch it spread.
Mm-hmm. And empathy plays a really important role in this as well, being able to picture yourself in someone else's shoes and then understanding what they need to be able to change or to improve, et cetera, too.
Huge. Yeah, totally.
Have you experienced any organization where they just, you know, you were asked to make an impact or to work with a particular person, but that person was unwilling or didn't want to do it, and you just had to pass just because you knew that this was not going to end well?
Yeah. So some of our current clients, no, just kidding. We always have that conversation, right? We always run into that conversation with people. And that's because we have all grown up in the environment of top-down training by events, yeah. and the concept of bottoms-up learning as a process is totally foreign, right? I've never thankfully had to fire a client because of this. I think people have always come around to the idea once they see it in practice, and that's really important. So you've got to, one of the other recommendations I make is pilot this first. Like, don't try and boil the ocean with this idea. You know, start with five or six people.
Small.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just get results, and you let those people do the talking for you.
Yeah. And to your client's credit, the fact that they are reaching out for help already indicates that they understand that there needs to be change, et cetera, right? Nobody reaches out if they think everything's perfect and hunky-dory. Yeah. No one's going to bring in a consultant group to spend money on something when it's already perfect. So.
Yeah, that's right. And the only problem is when they think they know what the solution is as well. Right? that's where you just have to have that conversation.
That's where the 3-day webinar comes in, and canoeing and camping exactly. with the executive team comes. Like, you know, if we could only send our executive team to Hawaii for the weekend, I think we could fix everything. There's got to be a webinar out there, right?
I love that 3-day webinar. Yeah, that's a classic one. They're like, oh, and they just bring us in to build it for them. You know, like, no, that's not how it works.
It should be that easy for all of us, right?
It definitely should be.
Well,
and that's a good point, Brent. Maybe as kind of like one of the closing thoughts here is that if it was easy, everyone would be doing it, right? And this is not an easy thing. Getting this type of culture, the stuff we've been talking about, place is not easy. But what we're trying to do is to show it's possible.
Yeah, does anybody ever say, yes, we kind of know we need to do this, but we just aren't ready, or we just don't want to?
It's not that they're not ready or don't want to. It's more that they need to show immediate results. And so then they can't, right? So then it's like, we'll create this one-off event and a bunch of bells and whistles and blah, blah, blah. And then like that gets the person who signed off on the budget happy temporarily. It might even sometimes show a short-term, you know, positive improvement, but you haven't fixed the problem. You haven't done any long-term thing. So that's probably the biggest reason.
I just thought of, I wanted to ask this before we wrap up for today, is I know a lot of consultants who tell me, when they go into a business, the last people they want in a room when they're getting things started is the training team. And they know it's going to be a training problem, because the in-house training team is always their biggest hurdle, the biggest issue that they have to get past, get over, and whatnot. As an external consultant going in with a client, do the training teams embrace what you're there to do and help, or do you find that type of resistance as well?
Yeah, so it's so different, depends on the individual. I think to generalize a bit, I find people who are charged with, and apologies if it's, I don't know if you guys can still hear me, we just have a landscaping happening right outside us here. But I'll talk closer to the mic. Anybody who does compliance training tends to think in a sort of check the box, just get this thing out, and it, you know, meets the requirements for that year. Those are hard, and we stay away from all compliance training.
Yeah.
Anybody who really is passionate about seeing potential in others and helping to unlock that potential. And there's a lot of people like that out there, right? I think that's a lot of people drawn to this profession who feel like that. Yeah. They're the ones that get it, right? And those are the people we love working with.
Yeah, and we love working with them too, speaking of working with those people. But these are all of the people that sit in our chat, and we're so grateful for everybody to hang out in the chat. Thank you so much, Andrew, for hanging out with us today. This has been fantastic.
Yeah.
Thank you,
folks. If you haven't noticed, Adam in the chat is Adam whipped up a cartoon based on a prompt from Brent earlier in the day, and he's got a link to it there. Also, Andrew has tossed in all of his connections. So if you're looking to connect with Andrew in different places, there's some links in there. Speaking of links, I'm going to toss in, folks, you know, Domino Learning System sponsors our session here every week. And if it's something that's of interest, we just tossed a link in there to check out Domino One, something you might want to follow up with.
Exactly. And if lastly, you are not a member of our group, our LinkedIn group, I'll be dropping that link into the chat. Very cool. Now.
Awesome. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us here today. Thanks to everybody in the chat. As always, some great observations, some great questions, some great things happening over there. And we look forward to seeing everybody back again next week.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks, Brent. Thanks, everyone, for the great questions.
Yeah, in the meantime, let's dance on out of here, guys. Have a great rest of your Wednesday and a great rest of the week.
Let's do it. Let's do it. Thanks, everybody. I look forward to seeing everybody out on the social media and joining us next week. For sure. Adios, everybody.